Good evening. This is Jill Ajizi, and this is Family Matters. And, of course, our wonderful, wonderful co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence, is here. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Jill. Dr. Star,
how are you?
A guest. How are you all?
Very well. Thanks. We are all fine, and I want to introduce our guest, Dr. Leslie Starr. It's just such a lovely name. Hi, Leslie. We're happy to have you here. I need to talk about a couple of things before we get started. Of course, what I really want to mention, my group, Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, of which I am president, is having Parental Alienation Awareness Day on April 25th all around the world, and there are events going on everywhere. I'd like to make special mention of a lovely woman in Dallas, Texas, Wendy Archer, who is doing a bang-up job down there, getting proclamations from mayors left and right, and has a great day planned. I just got a call before I got on from Good Morning Dallas that they want us on April 11th, which is so outstanding. So keep up the good work down there, Wendy, in Dallas. I know you're listening. And just anybody who wants to be a part of PAAD Day, please let us know, and you can go on our site at www.paawareness.com. I also would be remiss if I did not say that John McCune from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and he is now a partner in syndicatednews.net. It is so exciting to have John and his music affiliated with our station. So excited. Ruthie DiTucci continues as, of course, the president and publisher of Syndicated News, and we're just lucky to have both of them affiliated with us. We also have a live stream now, a television stream from Tokyo and Dublin, which is so exciting. So check that out on syndicatednews.net, and you'll see what we're up to and how we're progressing day by day. Okay, tonight we have, of course, Dr. Leslie Starr, as we said. And Leslie, I would just want to talk a little bit about what you have done in your life, which is so exciting. You have a PhD in educational psychology from Marquette University, a master's degree in counseling from the University of Wisconsin, and undergraduate degree is from the University of Wisconsin. You're a cheesehead. Where are you from, Wisconsin?
I am from Wisconsin, but I've been here in Illinois longer than I lived in Wisconsin.
Wow. Well, Wisconsin is a beautiful place, but we're glad to have you as part of being an Illinoisan and having you here to do the great work that you do. You are involved in, you've had 3 years of postdoctoral training in forensic psychology.
Yes.
And you work now in the Cook County Courts as a 604B evaluator.
Correct.
And tell us why you're in this field.
Well, I can tell you why I'm in forensics generally. I think that it has made me a better psychologist. By forensics, I mean doing work that has the potential to be scrutinized in a court of law. And I think that having been a clinician and had a practice in therapy, I know that therapists can sit in their offices and say many things, and seldom do their clients and patients cross-examine them. But when you write a report for the court, you know that literally every word that you write and everything that you say is subject to be questioned by three smart attorneys and a smart judge. So it makes you much more careful about what you put out there.
You know, it's as I was listening, your credentials, Dr. Starr, I was thinking I was in my courtroom and you were going on the witness stand, because actually we have done that live at the Apollo. You have testified in my court numerous.
I have.
So people don't all know what 604B is. 604B is a lettering that has only to do with Illinois law. But we think, you know, we live in this world, and we think that everybody gets what it is. But you are the first in a series, Dr. Starr, that Jill and I are doing on what really goes into a custody case or a contested visitation or alienation case. Mm-hmm. So we're going piece by piece. And tonight we're starting with one of the first things that happens when there's conflict. Would you explain to everybody what a 604 is?
I sure will. First of all, I need to, I think, define the population that I work with. And these, when a lot of people get divorced, we estimate like 50% or so. The majority of people who get divorced go and get divorced. They may or may not even have attorneys. They may come to their own agreement, settlement, and go and have it approved by the judge, and they're divorced, and that's it. The people that I work with are the most high-conflict cases. They're people who are kind of have intractable problems that are not amenable, usually, to the typical divorce case scenario. So they usually come to me at the end of a road, and that the road would be they come to the court and they have disputes, and the court recommends they go to see our program Focus on Children, which is a movie and some discussion about how to have a better divorce, I guess. If that doesn't help, then they go to mediation, where they try to, you know, come to the, again, their own agreement about how to settle matters of finances, but more important, what's going to happen to the children. If that doesn't work, then sometimes a child representative is appointed, and that person would, again, try to negotiate a settlement. And if all of those measures fail, then ultimately they come to someone like me who does a forensic investigation of what the issues are in the case and makes recommendations to the court about who should have custody of the children and what parenting time should be. So that's a 604B. And I don't know, maybe you know, Judge Lorenz, what they call it in other states.
Well, everybody's got a different name for the evaluation.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So they could call it 50 other things.
But yeah, whatever their numbers are in their
usually state. Is, you know, child or family evaluation or custody evaluation or something like that.
Right.
I guess I have a question. I mean, this whole series came about because I told Michelle that in my own case, a custodial parent that's an alienated mother, I never knew about the option of a custody evaluator. It never came to that. A court. I had a lawyer appointed for my daughter. Mm-hmm. And son, and nothing ever came of that. There was no real advocacy on behalf of those children on her part. And $47,000 later, you know, it was done. And so what you're doing never came up. How do people become alerted of the fact that this is a possibility in their case?
Well, I'm usually not around when that happens, but what the clients have told me is that often one or the other of the parents' attorneys will petition for such an evaluation, and then even then some first measures may be tried before the evaluation is ultimately ordered. I think the child rep, I know the ones I've worked with, often say to the parents, let's try to sit down and negotiate so you can avoid a 604B, the
mm-hmm.
expense of it and the anxiety of having to go through it, I guess. But maybe Judge Lorenz would speak to that. How would one know?
Well, it would either one of the two lawyers or both would decide that there is an issue as to custody or a contested issue as to visitation, or the potential for one parent being alienated, and they want to be able to freeze frame that with an evaluator who says either it is happening or it isn't happening. But we'll get to that. I don't want to jump ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So just to keep it from the beginning stages, it's going to be one of the two lawyers. The court can do it on its own motion, or it's going to be the third option, which is going to be the child representative or the guardian ad litem. So let's say I was going to appoint Dr. Starr on a case that would go in a court order. Generally, the fees are fixed on a temporary basis, subject to change. And, you know, people don't like to have the evaluations because they are costly, because they're very work intensive. So Dr. Starr gets evaluated, and then the ball is in her court as to who she wants to see. So she'll get the phone call from somebody, and then she can tell us what happens next.
Yeah, it's interesting because from my office, I can see the Daily Center where the courts are. And I have no idea what's going on over there. I seldom get a call ahead of time. Usually the first person to contact me is one of the parties, as just happened today. A woman called up, and they'll generally say, you need to evaluate my son or my daughter. And I say, who are you?
Right.
You were appointed to do an evaluation for my son. And as I question the client, then it becomes clear that it really was a 604B and it's a custody evaluation, not, you know, a psychological evaluation of a child. From there, I have to hunt up the court order. And sometimes there's quite a lag, Your Honor, between when I get appointed and when I get the order. If nobody calls me, if none of the parents call me, I don't know I've been appointed most of the time. And sometimes it's 3 months before the order gets sent to me. So I really can't do anything without that court order because, well, and each is different. Sometimes the judges will specifically say, you will do this and you won't do that, which is helpful to know what the parameters are. Most often, the order says you're going to do a custody evaluation, which is sort of leaves me at liberty to try to define what the issues are. Sometimes judges will have the attorneys write questions for me. It's kind of funny. We have a statute here that the court is supposed to take into consideration certain factors in determining custody, and those are called 602 factors because of where they're described. But most often when attorneys write questions, they write questions from those factors. You know, are there any mental health issues that would impact on this person's ability to parent, for example? And so you get an order that is either specific or nonspecific, and then the process begins.
So
I guess, Leslie, what I want to ask you is, I'm a little bit confused because I think, you know, in a perfect world, Michelle and I would like to see people coming into divorce court with a parenting plan where they're invested in their child's future and things are worked out and everything is great. But why would you not have a custody evaluation before all of this happens, instead of waiting to the very last step?
My answer to that is that these are very expensive, as Judge Laurent said, labor-intensive, intrusive evaluations. And I think that trying to do something to give the parents more say in what's going on and trying to have them negotiate their own agreement is, I think, looked at as a better way to go. And it, in my opinion, is a better way to go because if you have something imposed on you, you're less likely to want to do it than if it's a parenting plan that you came up with yourself. But for some people, it's impossible for them to reach that agreement. And as I said, I'm dealing with a very small population of the divorcing population.
Mm-hmm. That, and one of the other benefits, if you could call it a benefit to a 604B evaluation, is that when that evaluation comes out, the family can have a recipe or a game plan for what they need to do to be better, what kind of help their children might need, whether there's a learning disability or attention deficit disorder or whether there's anger management problems. And sometimes it's kind of explosive, but it does, Dr. Starr, it does provide often a roadmap.
Well, hopefully that's what we're aiming for.
So let's say the case comes to you, and what's the first thing that you do?
The first thing I do, as I mentioned, is I have to have the court order. I can't do anything without that. And then I send out, we get the court order, we open the case, you know, and put it into all of our systems in the office, and we send letters out to the attorneys for the parents, telling them these are the retainer requirements if it's not spelled out in the court order, and here's a copy of the agreement I'm going to ask your client to sign, so please look it over, and if you have any thoughts or questions, give me a call. And then I usually also tell the attorneys I would prefer that they not call me directly, but that they, any communication they have with me, they put in writing and send a copy to the other attorney. Once I get the retainer, then I set up appointments with the parents and I get started. Shall I go on?
Yeah. Okay. So will you see a child first or the parents first?
No, I see the parents first. My reason for that is that I really like to know a lot about the situation before I meet the children. I like to know what each parent's thought about the child or children are. Sometimes one parent will say, you know, this child is has some emotional problems. The other parent says, no, he's perfectly fine.
Perfectly fine.
Sometimes I had one case I remember where the argument was the child gifted? And if he was gifted, where should he go to school? And the parents had very disparate ideas about that. So,
Leslie, do you see them together, or is that almost impossible in some cases?
Well, I also am a mediator, and I make a pretty bright line between what I do in each case. If I'm an evaluator, no, I'm not going to see them together. There isn't any need for me to see them together. If they tell me we don't get along and we are at each other's throats, you know, every time we get within 10 feet of each other, I can believe that. I don't really need to see that for myself. So, no, I see each parent separately. They do 1.5-hour sessions with me because that's about how long my concentration can be pretty intense. And it usually takes 2 to 3 1.5-hour sessions for them to complete the interview questions that I have. But some people take longer, some people take one session. You know, everybody's different. But they all get asked the same questions. And then I do psychological testing with each of the parents and with any other people who are playing a surrogate role with the children, new spouses, boyfriends, girlfriends, fiancés, significant others who've met the children and spent time with them. If the parent is dating but the date has not met the children, then I might interview that person as a collateral over the phone. But you have to tell the new spouses, boyfriends, girlfriends that they are not obligated to be in this evaluation. They're doing it, you know, to be helpful to their new partner. So,
well, let's stop for a second and explain collaterals to our listeners.
Sure. Collaterals are people who might have information pertinent to the case. Usually, there are certain professionals that I would obviously try to interview, and that would be teachers, pediatricians, therapists, if the parents will give me permission, either therapists of the children or marital therapists that the parents went to before. They might include babysitters, grandparents, sometimes friends and neighbors. But I really don't, I'm not trying to make phone call time for myself. If a parent is giving me a list of 25 of their closest friends who are going to tell me how wonderful the parent is, then I would prefer that those people send me a letter because it takes me 2 minutes to read a letter and almost always at least 20 minutes on the phone with someone. So those would be examples of collaterals.
Well, you bring up a really hot topic, and I you probably know what I'm going to ask you, because if the child's in therapy or the parents are in therapy,
mm-hmm.
there's a big issues of confidentiality. It's always the big debate. Does a 604BU, in this case,
mm-hmm.
get to speak to the therapist or get to talk to the child's therapist? So we'll get to the alienation part, which
yeah.
really becomes important with the child's therapist.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, it's a
problem?
It's up to the let's say that mother has had a therapist. It's up to mother whether I can talk to that person or not, and I don't push. You know, I ask, and I suggest they talk to their attorney if they, you know, have some hesitation. If they say no, then it's no, and that's the end of it. If they say yes, then almost always it's yes, but sometimes the therapist can intervene, I guess, and say, no, I think it would be harmful for me to talk to you about this person, so I'm not going to do it.
Well, Leslie, why would they ever say that? If it's going to give you a clear picture of exactly what's going on, then
because,
why would anyone hesitate to say it's okay?
Well, because of the therapeutic relationship. It can be damaged. If the therapist is going to tell me things that are, let's say, negative about the mother, I'm picking on mothers today, but it could be the father or the child, they may not want to risk damaging their therapeutic alliance with that patient by telling me things that, you know, aren't going to be ultimately helpful. So that's why.
Because then, that, for example, and this happens in the court all the time, if mom's got a therapist and the therapist says, well, she's doing okay, she could be doing better, right away the relationship's pretty much over because nobody wants to be talked about. It's the confidentiality, which is held so sacred in the healing process. But it comes up all the time because there'll be a claim by one side of some real serious pathology.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of goes in waves. I don't know if you think this, Judge Lorenz, but years ago it was everybody was bipolar. She's bipolar, her mother's bipolar, the dog's bipolar, and then it changed to borderline. And the claim was she's borderline, her mother's borderline, the dog is borderline. Now it's kind of come back to bipolar. That seems to be the most frequent claim. And it most often isn't true.
What do you base trends like that on?
I don't know.
Wild.
What's the worst thing I could say about this person is what where I think the trend comes from. Because most of the time, as I say, it isn't true. But I will tell you this, that in recent years, I have had more legitimately bipolar clients, and not only that, but bipolar with psychosis to the tune of riding down the street naked, you know, and doing money and things. But I think that's kind of the unusual case, but I've had several of them, and they're quite tragic.
Any theory as to why there's more?
I really don't know. I've never had them up until maybe 5 years ago. And since in the last 5 years, I've probably had three or four. They happened to be women who were seriously bipolar. But, you know, the issue that I was asked to decide in those, or not decide, pardon me, to make a recommendation about in those cases was not who gets custody, but how does this woman purge herself under the conditions of her bipolarity of supervised visitation.
Yeah.
So it was looking for
what
that
happened?
Plan. I'm sorry?
What happened?
It depends on the case. I mean, in one case, I suggested a year-long course of treatment. These kids were older. They were teenagers, so it was a little, you felt a little bit, you know, they were able to advocate for themselves and make phone calls and stuff. It wasn't like a four-year-old. The mother was already compliant with treatment, and there were therapists in place, and we just, you know, I suggested that her visitation be gradually expanded. From what I hear from the child's rep when we talk about this case, she's doing great. Another case, it was a very tragic case of a woman who was an attorney originally, and when I met her, she was prostituting herself on the street.
Oh.
She didn't think she was bipolar, and, you know, I recommended this a similar year-long course for her, but she wasn't even of a mind to begin it because there was nothing the matter with her. So,
What is the difficulties for in the parenting difficulties for a bipolar parent in parenting their child if they're not medicated?
Well, these women were extreme. I mean, you can imagine the woman who was prostituting herself, also she would have these wild ideas. She decided she was going to be a rap artist, so she was following around the country this rap artist who was giving concerts. And she had another little baby, you know, outside of the marriage, the child in the marriage, and had gone into a hospital and ran out into the street with her pants down with this baby, and DCFS came and took that child. So, I mean, you know, I'm talking about very extreme and erratic and unpredictable behavior, which is not always bipolar. These women were also psychotic.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about, well, Jill, I'm going to let you, what we were talking earlier, to move into the parent alienation questions.
Okay. Well, I think it's really important, and of course we all know that time is the friend of an alienator. So by the time these children are getting to you, Leslie, and you're seeing a custody evaluation of children that have been alienated. Now, it took 4 weeks and 6 days for the alienation of my children. So some people it's a little longer. So, you know, it just depends on how good the alienation tactics are. But how do you deal with that particular situation when it's presented to you?
With alienation?
Yes.
When you say how do I deal with it, you mean what recommendations for me?
Obviously, there's some people that don't even recognize that parental alienation syndrome, the resulting syndrome to the children, exists. I'm assuming that you're on board with that. If you're not, that's fine. I mean, we you know, everybody can offer whatever opinions they want to on this show,
mm-hmm.
but I know that exists. And exists in my own children, but when people are coming to you for custody evaluations and you have a very strong alienator who's telling you what's going on, and then you see the target parent who does not have the upper hand in the situation, and then the children who at that point maybe at the severe level, how do you make a recommendation based on that particular situation?
I make it with difficulty. I just want to go back to something you said about parent alienation syndrome. And I think what I would say, and I think most mental health persons would say, is the Gardner version of PAS, parent alienation syndrome, is not something that we hearken to, because it wasn't based on good research. It was based on Gardner's experience with a couple, you know, some of his individual clients. But that is not to say that there isn't a psychological construct of alienation that is very apparent. And I would point out its sister or brother disorder, if you like, of estrangement. And have you guys talked on your show about the difference between those two things?
Tell us.
Okay. Well, alienation is what you described, Jill, and that is where a parent seeks out to damage the relationship between the children and the other parent. If they're younger, often they can do that through suggestibility because the children are quite malleable. But really, I think, most vulnerable kids to alienation are the preteens and the teens, because they are old enough to understand a little bit of what's going on, and if they are fed certain information, they're more prone to take sides. So that's alienation. On the other hand, there might be something called estrangement, where the children are estranged from the other parent, but it's because of the behavior of the parent. The parent was abusive or sexually abusive or rejecting, and in that way the child came, you know, to have not such good feelings toward the parents. So those are kind of two sides of a coin. I don't know if you guys talk about that too much.
Well, it comes up
anytime you say the word, because the person who is doing the alienating technically would be the one to say, it's not me, it's what the parent really did.
Yeah.
So it is the ultimate fine razor thin line that goes back and forth. And it's dumped in your lap, people who do what you do, to make that distinction and to do the crime scene investigation on that. How do you do that? What goes into that?
Well, and sometimes there's both. I mean, you know, there's nothing to say that there couldn't be both things. How do you do it? Well, through the methods that I don't think I finished describing, you know, interviewing the parent, listening to what each parent is saying. Parents who alienate often say things like this: my kids don't want to see the other parent, and, you know, I can't. They can make up their own minds. They're old enough, and if they don't want to do it, I'm not going to force them. And that isn't necessarily alienation in and of itself, but it's sort of a red flag, because these will be the same parents who are very on top of everything else their kids do. It's, you know, they are making sure the kids are into school and they have certain friends and they do things a certain way. But suddenly, just in this one area, they're handing over decision-making, in a sense, to children who are not at an age where they can reasonably make those decisions, and saying, well, you know, my kids don't want to do it.
And these are the same children that they would not allow to choose what school they were going to, or what doctor they were going to see, or if they wanted to go to school, but they will allow them not to see the other parent.
Right. So you listen for things like that. You listen to things, well, you know, and both parents will kind of give you the mirror image of the relationship. You know, the other parent might tell you things like, well, she came and she installed a device in my car and the kids were with her. And, you know, they have corroboration of that. Or they are encouraging the children to act out against the other parent and saying, you know, well, I mean, that's just how he feels. It's sort of that same issue again. They're doing things that, as you uncover the investigation, like, for example, not giving the parent the phone bill to pay for the kids' cell phones, and the kids' cell phones get turned off, and then the parent says, well, see, you know, he doesn't care about you. He won't even pay for your cell phone. And so blaming, finding ways to manipulate and blame. And that kind of an issue would come to light in the course of the investigation, where, you know, you could see emails going back and forth, or you could see phone bills, or you could see payments made, et cetera. Sometimes parents who are alienating will say things like, well, I had to tell my children the truth.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was an affair, and, you know, I just had to tell them. Even, they're 8 years old, but they had to know that, because I don't lie to my children. Not all parents who say, I don't lie to my children, are alienators, but again, it's another sort of an indicator, a flag. So you're looking for those kinds of things. And when you talk to the children, you know, that's the next thing. What are they saying about the parents? Can they say anything good about the parent who's been alienated? Or is it completely cut off and, you know, dark? So each case is different. As I said, some cases have both alienation and estrangement in it, and usually that becomes clear through the course of talking to collaterals, talking to the children, talking to the parents, looking at documents, you know, police reports. And
well, I guess I just want to stop you for a second, because I guess I just have to agree on that, or disagree on the point that every case is different. And when I talk to people from California to Maine, and from Minnesota to Florida, that have the exact same, it's almost as if it's a football playbook that they're going right down, and these alienators are using each step to complete the final process of alienation for these parents, both men and women, because this is not a gender issue.
It isn't.
And save a few nuances, every case is exactly the same.
Yeah.
Well, I would say there are more similarities than differences, but each case presents, you know, with some slight variations. But you're right. They're, at the core of them, it's the same thing.
The smell test, it always has that feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like the children aren't safe with the other parent. That's always present. There's something that the child should worry about. Something.
Oh,
like,
I can remember sitting on the set of The View with Alec Baldwin and him saying, I said something about my children have said over the last week and a half that they're afraid to be with me. And he said, yeah, that's what Ireland's saying. She's afraid to be with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that parents will instill, alienating parents will instill, that you have to be frightened to be with that other parent. And, I mean, I'm telling you, you know, if I had had a custody evaluation and somebody had talked to me, I mean, literally my kids were attached to my hips. So I don't know how a custody evaluator, unless they were manipulated by the system, could have found any other reason to say that those kids did not belong in the home of an alienator.
Well, that's another knotty problem, is once you discern that there's alienation, now what do you do about it?
What do you do? Good question, Leslie.
I was kind of asking that question. Well, are you familiar with Warshak's work?
Absolutely.
I know you are
a dear friend of mine. I just talked to him today.
Oh, no kidding. No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he has sort of a four-tiered suggestion of what you do in such cases. And the first tier is to leave the children with the alienating parent and, you know, try some measures.
Mm-hmm.
I think that traditional therapy doesn't work usually so well because a therapist is the client's advocate. And so if the child is saying, I'm afraid of my mother or father and I don't want to see them, then kind of the leaning is to go with that. So traditional therapy is maybe not exactly what's needed. Now I know, and maybe you can speak more to his program. I'm not that familiar with his program. He has workshops that the alienating family,
mm-hmm,
everyone goes to. Are you familiar with that?
It's a reunification program, basically,
yeah,
is what it is. And it's extremely successful.
Mm-hmm. Please speak about it.
Well, what Richard does is, I mean, basically just work through it with the families. And he's in Dallas, Texas, and he will, you know, he will go to any lengths to make these kinds of things happen. I'm not going to say it's not costly, and I'm not going to say that you have to be there. He can even do it by Skype. But what he does in working with the families, and I've never actually been in one of the programs. I had all of my children and myself and my ex-husband also with him, and I couldn't get anybody to go except me. So I didn't think it was very
probably didn't need to do that.
So he's having a great success rate at what he's doing. But the problem, Leslie, is that he's one guy. And really, there's a handful of people in the United States and across the world who do reunification programs. And then the other part of it is finding a therapist who is able to address this issue. You clearly know what it is, but to find someone in Central Illinois or Southern Illinois who you can have work with your children, they're non-existent.
Yeah, I don't know that it's even that easy in Chicago. What do you think, Judge?
I think it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you have, and now I'm just talking from my perspective, is a child who refuses to go to therapy. And the lawyers will come in and say the child won't go. How do you, I mean, and I'm asking Dr. Starr, how do you leverage a child to go?
I don't know the answer to that either. It's like, you know, what do you do with that 500-pound gorilla in the corner? And the older they are, the harder it is. If you have like a 15 or 16-year-old, man, they're going to turn themselves inside out if they don't want to do what you're asking of them, you know. So
I mean, I try and get creative. I say, like, well, if you'll go for dinner, then I won't order overnights. Okay. It's at the far scale, and the child won't go no matter what. But if I could, you know, trick the child a little bit into saying, well, you'll have control if you have options. Mm-hmm. Which one do you want to pick?
Mm-hmm.
When really the child's picking zero, I don't want any of it. And one of the other things I noticed, guys, is these children are really protective of the alienator.
Oh, yeah.
And all they want is to get the other parent to back off so it's not so difficult on their parent.
Yeah,
they're really advocates.
They've been parentified. They've become the parent to take care of the quote-unquote wounded parent. They've been given way too much information and way too much power, and they see their role as protector. And I think especially as they get older. But sometimes not. I mean, I've seen an 8-year-old who was, as you've just described. The second option, as you know, for Rorschach is to change the custody to the other parent. And that was Richard Gardner's notion, that immediately that should happen. I think that my sense is that courts are less likely to do that willy-nilly. And I think Rorschach points out something very important, and that is that if you're going to make that change, the other parent should have a better environment. Because in the cases where you have both estrangement and alienation, sometimes it isn't really a better environment that, you know, you have as an option.
We can look at the Dwayne Wade case that Jim Pritikin, his attorney, where he's going to speak for Michelle and I at an upcoming seminar we have on May 21st at DePaul Law Center. And Dwayne Wade, just a couple of Fridays ago, had custody reversed and received custody of his children. And so how – were you familiar with that case at all?
No. I'm going to say no.
Okay.
I can't speak to it. I know the case you're talking about, though.
Well, Michelle, you know the case. What can you say about that and why you think that?
Bill, you are barking up two wrong trees because
I'm not barking.
I can't comment on the case.
Fine, all right. Oh, yeah, you can't comment on the case. Never mind. Sorry, be quiet. I forgot you were a judge for a minute. Sometimes I just with a dancer. Sorry. Anyway,
it's just an example that custody was changed in a case where they found alienation.
Yeah. And I think sometimes when there's severe alienation, that's exactly what you have to do. And I think then those people have been down the long road and they've been through custody evaluation and all of the pieces of the puzzle have been put together to make that really incredibly difficult decision to switch custody to the other parent.
Yeah. How old were those kids?
I don't know, Michelle. Do you know? They're young, aren't they?
Yes, I think they're both under 10.
Yeah, and that plays into part of making a recommendation, too, is the age of the child, because, as you say, for a 16-year-old, even though it might be the quote-unquote right thing to do, a 16-year-old can make it impossible to implement.
Sure.
Sometimes.
Now, we've talked about, let's go back to, you were talking about, you know, evaluating the parents, talking to the children, and you said that these custody evaluations could take up to 3 months, and I'm sure sometimes longer. Much longer?
They usually, for me, and this is all I do, I am a evaluator, and I don't sit around, you know, lolling around on the case, and it usually takes me between 3 and 5 months. So 3 would be fast.
Okay. So how many interviews would you have with the parents and the children then? Is it just a preliminary thing, or do you have ongoing talks?
Well, yeah, we're talking to parents kind of constantly, but specifically my interview is a 5-page semi-structured interview, meaning these are, you know, there's certain areas I'm going to ask about. I'm going to ask about transitions and phone calls, if appropriate, and development and, you know, bedtime routines and what you think the strengths of the other parent are, you know, and many of those questions. The most of the interview is the parent telling me the story of the marriage, and that's more open-ended. So I said 2 to 3 1.5-hour sessions, but every parent gets asked the same questions. Some people are much more rich in their discussion. And
but why is the history and the story of the marriage important to the future of the children? Why is the past important to the future?
Well, it explains, it helps me to clarify, because as I said, often the court order I get is open-ended. So I need to define what the issues are. And in the parents telling me the story of the marriage, I find out what the issues are between the parents. And,
okay.
You know, I mean, that's kind of what the evaluation is about. What are the issues? But it, you know, there's more than that. That's usually what takes the longest. But then there's all sorts of other follow-up questions about specific things I need to know.
I'm sorry, were you going to say something? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there are two other options that Warshak mentions I'd like to mention, just so we have the complete four-pronged tier. If neither environment is good for the child, another option is to recommend residential placement elsewhere. Now, that takes some money, as most of these things do. I've seen that tried in one situation, and both of the parents sabotaged the placement in the residential facility that was out of state. So, but that was only one case. And then the last thing that Warshak suggests is that no resolution is possible, and there's, you know, a moratorium on anybody seeing anyone. I think that this is, the idea is that someday the children will come to their senses and they will renew contact. But I think that this has very bad ramifications for the children, because it prolongs the alienation. And sometimes kids can, you know, look at this as, well, there he goes, he's abandoned me forever. So those are kind of the four remedies for alienation that have been proposed.
So isn't getting a 604B evaluation, doesn't that cause people to need to take sides against each other? When I was a lawyer and you had to prep people, and people, I don't know whether you know this, Dr. Starr, but lawyers do prep their clients for this.
Really?
Yes, they do. And I have.
I'm surprised.
And I'm shocked. You know, you have to say, if you feel this negative thing about their parenting ability, you can't be shy. You have to say it. All is at stake here. So the system, by the nature of a 604B, encourages the blaming. So
yeah.
That you can come out on the good side. So where you may not have had a full-blown alienator to begin with, you get the beginnings of an alienator just because of the evaluation. Would you comment on that?
I think that that's true. It does encourage polarization and people to probably make their points more emphatically than they might otherwise. Another thing that it sometimes does is calm people down. And I've heard that comment from parents. You know, since we had this 604B, this person's on their best behavior and everything's going fine right now because the court's looking and the evaluator's looking and the child rep is looking. It's not just the 604B. But I think our court system, you know, that's kind of the way the system is built. And it does sharpen the polarity between the clients often and make it worse in that sense.
I think so. But what do you do when you see, is there something that can be done? Because I'm working on, you know, the perfect court order. When you see the beginnings of alienation, what would you like to see the courts do or the parenting agreements do to try and keep that in control?
Wow.
I know.
Great question.
It is a great question. Is it 7 o'clock already?
The show.
Well, I believe, and I think research supports this, that children need relationships with both of their parents. And so often I've seen manipulators get, and it's been men in the cases I'm thinking of, but it could be women too, get the women into a compromising situation so that they get into an argument or he provokes an argument, and then the police are called and the mother is, in these cases I'm thinking of, is taken away. And then that starts, you know, she's nuts and she's crazy and she attacked me and she needs supervised visits. Or she shouldn't have any visitation time with the kids because she's, you know, too crazy. But unless it's a very, very, very specific and unusual situation, children need to have contact with both of their parents. So I guess I would like to see a court order where that was happening.
Usually I do. Do you have an opinion about more visitation for the non-custodial parent as a philosophy?
Do I have an opinion on more visitation for the non-custodial?
Yeah, more contact, you know, more shared contact.
Well, she already advocates for shared parenting, so I'm assuming you want a 50-50 kind of relationship unless there's some issue, right?
50, I didn't say 50-50.
Can't assume.
I didn't say 50-50. I think that each parent needs to be involved, and it depends, some of it depends on the age of the child. If it's a very young child, it's important that both parents have a lot of contact with that very young child to keep the attachment. If it's an older child who's school age, I wouldn't advocate for 50-50 time because the child's main developmental task is learning. And I don't know about, I think that all of us are discombobulated when we have to move from place to place to place to place many times. And it's it doesn't help your ability to concentrate and focus. And that's what children need to do. They need to be out of the fray and able to focus and work on their schoolwork. So 50-50 parenting is not something I usually ever advocate for under any circumstances of school-age children during the school year.
What about the kind of studies that are starting to come up that are saying that, especially in the early stages of the divorce, the children have a lot of anxiety about losing a parent that might even eclipse their learning developmental tasks? What if they're really, you know, if you only see your parent every other weekend, isn't there a great deal of they say there's some bad chemicals coming to these kids because they worry a lot about whether they're going to lose that other parent.
Yeah, and that is of concern. And again, I think it's a balance that has to take into consideration the child's age. If there is a diagnosed anxiety disorder, that may change the picture, and maybe, you know, you want to expand things a little bit for that person, for that child, I mean. But I still think the child's main task is learning, and we should not focus on something else to the detriment of that.
So what do you think is the perfect time, then, Dr. Sharp?
Coming up.
Wait.
Michelle, what are you saying? Hang on. Go ahead, and then I want to ask this question.
Oh, I just made a comment. I wasn't asking a question. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask, what do you think is the perfect time to split then? How do you see it happening? What's your utopia for a parenting plan?
that each parent have sufficient, and that may be defined differently from, you know, incident to incident. Sufficient time with that child, depending on the child's age, to maintain the relationship with that child. And I know that's vague, but I can't be any more specific because it depends on the age of the child. It depends on, does the child have siblings that can help to buffer some of the effects of the divorce?
you know, what are the logistical matters of the parents? Are they living down the street from each other, or do they live, you know, two communities over? Did I already say age? I forgot what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about gender? What about the necessity for teenage boys needing more contact, perhaps with dads? Is there a factor there?
I'm only in the sense that it's child specific. I don't think that there's any axiomatic thing you can apply that boys should now have more time with their dads because they're 13.
Well, Leslie, Dr. Starr, if you had a magic wand, how would you change our system to minimize negative impact on kids?
Oh, well, wouldn't it be a perfect world if we could do everything collaboratively?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be my magic wand. And then I wouldn't be doing this work. I would be doing something else.
Yay. Yeah, well, Leslie, I just want to thank you both for being here tonight. And the show has flown by. We have about 2 minutes left. But I wanted to, I'm assuming you see people outside of court recommendations?
No.
No, you don't. Only that. So we don't even need to give your contact information out.
No, and when people call me up and ask me if I would be their evaluator, I tell them I really shouldn't talk to them because I shouldn't have a relationship with them before I'm appointed.
Right.
Don't forget, pro ses can go to court and get an appointed evaluator too. You don't just need a lawyer.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's a different case. But then they're acting as a lawyer when they talk to me.
Well, thank you so very much, Dr. Starr. And I want to say what makes you a good testifier at court is what makes you a good interviewee.
So, yeah, this was a great, great
well, wasn't it all traumatic?
No,
no
not
yes,
and I want to
invite, are we?
I'd like to invite everybody to a program that I'm giving on parenting and protecting yourself in divorce. If you're interested, it's free, just go to goodkarmarelationships.com, and we're going to go in depth on how to protect your heart and your soul and your kids.
What are the dates on that seminar?
April 16th and April 17th. It's at the Hyatt O'Hare.
And this is really important to hear, listening audience. This is free. Very few things that you're going to be offered in the divorce arena are going to be free. So I would take advantage of this, because if you don't, you're going to be sitting in a courtroom and you're going to be funding lawyers, children's college educations for the rest of your lives. So please listen to what I'm saying, because this will help you. If I had had Michelle's book and The Good Karma Divorce 6.5 years ago, I might have not spent $1 million on legal fees. So please listen up and look at her website and take advantage of what she is offering you, because it's not often you hear people like Michelle speaking out about what's wrong and what's right and how to fix it.
Thank you, Jill, and thank you so much again, Dr. Starr.
Oh, thanks for asking.
And
thanks for being here, Leslie. And I want to let you all know that are listening, the show has been recorded in its entirety and it is available for download later tonight. So if you missed anything that we were saying, please tune in. And don't forget, Parental Alienation Awareness Day, April 25th. Thank you both. Love you both. Glad you were here.
Thanks, Jill.
Okay.
Bye, Dr. Starr.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you later.